Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic watchword the past couple of weeks has been volatility, market swings that make you dizzy, good corporate news followed by bad news followed by worse. Today, the Federal Reserve decided it's had just about enough of that and gave us our new economic watchword. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 10th of August. Good to have you with us. To be fair, the lead story today started yesterday when the big French bank BNP Paribas froze three of its investment funds. As we told you, the European Central Bank pumped $130 billion into the system, trying to take some of the edge off a very nervous banking industry. The U.S. Federal Reserve followed suit overnight and into today. Other central banks did the same. The Fed itself has added $38 billion in excess capital just since this morning. In all, the global banking system has gotten $0.75 trillion shot in the arm since last night, which brings us to the word of the day, liquidity. We've asked Marketplace's Bob Moon for some help with a definition. Hiya, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
So here we have all these reports of the Federal Reserve injecting liquidity into the markets. What does that mean?
Well, let me answer you with a question here. When we think of money here, what do you think of?
Cash, coins, checks, cold hard stuff.
Right. When the financial markets deal with money, they prefer to think of it in liquid form. So you'll notice as we talk about what's been going on, you're going to hear a lot of terms that refer to money in terms of its liquidity, its liquid form.
That is its ability to flow from place to place.
That's right. So first example here, we've been talking for months, even a year or two now, about the flood of investment cash until recently. All you had to do was turn on the spigot, really, and the money flowed. There was so much money flowing, in fact, that the terms to borrow that cash were extremely favorable. Now that many of the banks are going to have to cover their losses from all these subprime defaults, that great reservoir of money has started drying up. So you turn on the faucet now, and the money is down to a trickle. That means a lot of banks that pump that money out to pay for everything from the mega takeover deals that we've been hearing about to just writing a mortgage are rationing the supply. And just as if it were water or gasoline, when there's less supply, the cost goes up, and the cost of borrowing money, in this case, is going up. So the Fed has now stepped in to prime the pump, if you will.
What exactly, though, does that mean? I mean, does Ben Bernanke wake up in the middle of the night and say, we need to get more money in the market, and he calls somebody and they open the bank vault?
Yeah, when your name's Bernanke, you've got your own well to dip into, really, here. That's why they call it the Federal Reserve. Follow me on this, if you will. Here's what's happened over the past few days. In the normal course of business, all the major banks across the country, when they need quick cash, they regularly borrow from each other. But the subprime mess has caused some of those financial institutions to become greater credit risks themselves, so they find they need to pay higher rates to dip into the cash pool that's left. The central bank aims to keep that lending rate between banks at 5.25%. But at one point in the past 24 hours, there was a report it had gone up as high as 6%. So in comes the Fed, which uses various means to pump more of its own cash out there. And today, the Federal Reserve issued a rare statement that it stands ready to, quote unquote, provide liquidity to facilitate the orderly functioning of the financial markets. Basically, they've told the country's big banks, come use our spigot. We'll loan you the money. We'll increase the flow of that cash at the cheaper interest rates that we can offer.
Let me hit you with a what if, Bob, before I let you go. What if the Fed had done nothing yesterday and today and just let things ride?
Well, one more liquidity reference here, Kai. There was real worry the money flow would turn to ice, and that could put a freeze on the whole economy here. You can speculate as well as I can about what that might have meant. The deals stop being made, Wall Street freezes up, it's not good news. So that's why they've got the backup pumps running now.
All right, Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
Let's pick up on that last thing Bob said, that the credit squeeze and fears of worse are responsible for stock market losses, hedge fund blowups, even that there's a recession out there on the horizon someplace. If that's true, why are some people on Wall Street breathing a sigh of relief right now? Marketplace's Amy Scott has the answers.
Things had clearly gotten out of hand.
We were in a period of national collective insanity.
Christopher Whalen is managing director of Institutional Risk Analytics. It's a risk management consulting firm. He says as the housing bubble kept inflating, banks were making so much money selling mortgages and mortgage defaults were so low, they forgot all about risk.
My little West Highland Terrier could probably have gotten a mortgage if I had dreamed up a Social Security number for Lucy.
A similar thing happened in the corporate world. Profit-hungry banks and investors lent more money more cheaply than they had in years. And just as in the mortgage market, they took on more and more risk. Some banks signed over money without insisting on traditional safeguards called covenants that protect lenders. Then all of a sudden, around late June, everything ground to a halt. More and more subprime borrowers found they couldn't pay their mortgages. Investors who'd been buying mortgage-backed securities started losing money. A few prominent funds collapsed. Mike Basevich invests in corporate debt for Hartford Investment Management. He says suddenly nobody would touch any kind of risky debt.
It all circles back to the subprime mess. It's a combination of weak lending standards and excessive leverage by both subprime lenders and certain hedge funds. And that's resulted in a number of big, well-publicized failures. And I think that uncertainty, the feeling that another shoe might drop, has been the reason behind the sudden market-wide aversion to risk.
In the past 6 weeks, investment banks have delayed dozens of financing deals because they can't find investors. Now it's tough for anyone to get money, from big corporations to people buying homes. Scott Minard oversees about $24 billion in bond investments for Guggenheim Partners Asset Management. He says he hasn't seen such a tight credit market since the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s.
I think that if less the Federal Reserve does something before the end of the year, that it's very highly likely that we would go into a recession as a result of the current credit squeeze.
The Fed is pumping more money into the market to keep borrowing rates stable, but officials don't appear ready to cut interest rates anytime soon. Steve Miller thinks the credit squeeze won't last long. He's managing director of Standard & Poor's Leveraged Commentary and Data. He says investors are turning up their noses at riskier loans, but they're still happy to buy good debt. He compares loans to real estate.
I think what we've seen is the loan market equivalent of properties that are in the leafy side of town with the good schools have kept their value much better than the ones that have been built sort of in the marginal side of town. Those are traded off significantly more than the traditional loans that had strong covenant packages and also low degrees of leverage.
Many investors may have pulled out of the market for now, but there are plenty of savvy buyers looking for ways to turn what some see as a crisis into cash.
It's a bargain hunter's paradise.
Debt investor Mike Basevich says he's buying up some of those bargains. He says the return to sanity in the credit market means better lending standards and more reward for risk. Lenders are putting those covenants back into loans, and interest rates are rising.
It's like a shot in the arm. It hurts when you take the shot, but over the long term, you know it's good for the health of the credit market.
S&P's Steve Miller says some $250 billion in bonds and loans is poised to hit the market in the coming months. He thinks investors will buy in, but they won't pay full price. Private equity firm Cerberus finally closed its deal to buy Chrysler last week, but the investment banks underwriting a portion of the loans lost 5 cents on the dollar. That's a $300 million discount. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
At the risk of repeating myself, I'll note the major indices made some serious moves up and down and up today. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Wall Street's nervous. We've established that. All the big banks and brokerages. It's the same for regulators. The SEC's looking into things now. And even the White House, where the president took care to make reassuring noises about the economy during a press conference yesterday. But what about the rest of us, the ones whose 401ks and pension plans are invested in some of the funds that have gone bad? We sent Steve Tripoli into the streets of a Boston suburb today to ask around.
The Boston Bean Coffee House in Maynard, Massachusetts was filling up with the noontime crowd when I stopped by today. I bumped into David Kindler as he was stepping into the soft rain outside. He told me he's invested in the market, but he says he's diversified and doesn't need his money soon, so he's not sweating.
I think that we seem to go in these cycles where, you know, there was a savings and loan crisis a number of years ago, and I think that things were more under control, and now I think the policy has been pretty lax on businesses. So I guess it doesn't really surprise me, and I guess I wouldn't be surprised for it to get worse before it gets better.
At a one-time textile mill that's now a mix of high-tech and professional offices, I ran into a group of lunch-bound workers. Chris Sharp is 36, Maggie Spatcher-LeBlanc's 29, and Paula Blomquist is the seasoned market player at 53. Worried? Chris answered first, then the youngest of the group, Maggie.
I'm not particularly concerned in the short term. I think long term it's going to, you know, work itself out.
I'm not worried at all. I agree with Chris. We're young enough that we have enough time in the market that our investments will be fine.
I wondered what other financial planners are hearing from their clients as the markets quake, so I called John Hickson in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
I'm not really hearing much of anything from clients because, you know, if I'm hearing a lot from clients, that means I don't have them properly positioned in the first place.
Hickson says he's been careful to manage his clients' expectations as the subprime drama deepened.
We're due for a market like this. This just happens to be what's triggering it.
But not everyone's feeling quite so calm. Back at the Boston Bean Coffee House, a young school teacher named Mike Stevens was reading about the market's problems in today's papers. With exchanges on most continents shaky right now, he says his investing game plan is under development.
So that's why at the moment I feel almost helpless as to know exactly what to do, short of taking all my cash out and burying it in the back of the garden. But I won't be doing that. No.
Better maybe to bury your head in a good novel and stay away from the headlines for a while. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Man, you guys got out of there with your chinny chin chin today.
Oh,
huh?
Come on. It was just another day in paradise.
Where does one start?
It was just
start?
Another reason why you love the market, because you never step in the same river twice. It's never.
Right.
It's always a little different. So you know who I was just trying to call?
No.
John Dimsdale, our friend John Dimsdale.
Yes,
he knows
I know
everything
well.
About Washington. Because I was going to ask him. I was going to say, John, my old friend of all these years. John, tell me the two guys whose names are going to be on the next bill. Because Sarbanes and Oxley already have their names, and they're already screwing up the financial markets. Who's going to get these hedge fund guys?
I have a question for you, though, and it revolves around another name. Starts with a B, ends with an E. Bernanke.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with interest rates? Are they going to actually do something, do you think? Could let me back up for a minute. Could a rate cut that people are now starting to talk about, could that fix this mess?
You know, I don't want to say I anticipated you, but I anticipated you. And I have it here in my hand a document dated August the 7th, which, come to think of it, was just a few days ago. And it's brief, one, two, three, four, five, four paragraphs of meat. And in the last paragraphs, the second phrase, the committee's predominant policy concern remains the risk that inflation will fail to moderate as expected. If these guys are fearful of inflation, you don't lower interest rates. Well, you know what we have to say about that, right?
Yeah.
That's what we have to say about that.
So did they blow it? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I think they're going to have to do something, probably lower interest rates. This injection of money that took place today, well, I guess it started yesterday in France, and then I think there were three, maybe four separate injections in the U.S. today, seems to have done the trick, but that's a short-term, you know, short-term stimulus, and I think they're probably going to have to do something.
All
I
right.
think they're probably going to have to lower
well,
interest rates.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If they come out next Tuesday or Wednesday, which is to say ahead of their next regularly scheduled meeting, and announce a rate cut, it's Katie bar the door, right? People are going to think, my God, if the Fed thinks we're in trouble and they're cutting rates, it must really be bad.
Maybe. I can guarantee you that's what would have happened this week. Because in essence, that's what we saw yesterday. When these French, the French who who had just a week ago told us everything was fine in those hedge funds, when the French had to come out and admit that, we don't really know what they're worth, and so you can't have your money back, which is not what you want to tell people. And then, of course, their bank turned around and, you know, it started injecting funds, and that's when everybody started worrying a lot. Now, it's not going to have the same impact if they do it next week. I don't think they're going to have to do it next week. But then again, I don't know. These things just, I remember from 89, and we were talking about the other day in 87, or from 1998, and these things just sort of run their course, and everything's all right ultimately. But I don't know when it's over with.
Yeah, quickly now, before you go, is there any rational thought taking place in the market these days?
No, I haven't seen any.
All right, David Johnson down in Dallas. Thank you, David.
Bye, Kai.
Coming up, universities trade on the prestige of their names, but at what cost?
We should guard that privileged position we have in American society very jealously. We shouldn't jeopardize it just for 30 shekels.
But first, let's do the numbers. After a wild ride, the Dow Industrials finished off just 31 points, about 0.25%, to close at 13,239. The NASDAQ fell 11 points, more than 0.4%, to end at 2544. The S&P 500 closed up just a tick, though, finished at 1453. For the week, after all the turmoil, the Dow actually finished 0.4% on the high side. The NASDAQ gained 1.3%. The S&P 500 added 1.4% on the week as well. The Fed's injection of all that money to the markets didn't stop financial stocks from taking a soaking. Countrywide Financial fell 2.75%. The country's largest mortgage lender said demand for its loans had dried up. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note was at 4.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for July. President Bush visits Washington, D.C. Veterans Affairs Medical Center. And on August 13, 1961, a barrier went up dividing East and West Berlin. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, but today city officials and artists are looking for ways to restore a crumbling stretch, keeping the artwork intact. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Congress is gone for the month, and immigration reform went nowhere. So today, the Bush administration released its own plan. Two cabinet secretaries, Michael Chertoff from Homeland Security and Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez, had the announcing honors. More than two dozen policies, some new, some already on the books. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The Bush administration said today it'll step up efforts to secure the border with Mexico, to expel illegal workers, and to enforce current immigration law. Rosemary Jenks is with Numbers USA, an organization that wants to cut the number of immigrant workers.
Well, on the one hand, it is really a breath of fresh air to see the administration talking about enforcement. On the other hand, let's get to it.
Some experts want more immigrant workers, not fewer, like Tamar Jacoby of the Manhattan Institute. Still, she too welcomes aspects of today's announcement.
This is good medicine. This is medicine we need, but we're missing the other medicine that has to go with it, which is a legal way to get the workers we need to grow the economy.
Congress went on summer recess without passing comprehensive immigration reform, so the Bush administration acted. The agriculture sector says the crackdown will cripple its business. Farmers nationwide face a major labor shortfall and estimated crop losses of $5 billion. Bob Daines with FAIR, a group that wants to limit immigration. He says farmers already have the H-2A visa program, which allows them to bring in an unlimited number of temporary workers.
That is an example of a program that's already in place with no restrictions, and it's a program that business can utilize to get cheap labor.
Farmers complain the visa program's filled with red tape. The Bush administration promises it'll overhaul the H-2A process to make it easier and faster. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Rescue crews in Minneapolis found an eighth body today in the wreckage of the I-35 West Bridge. It happened the same day Transportation Secretary Mary Peters was in the city. She delivered a $50 million installment of the $250 million that Congress has allotted to help with eventually rebuilding that span. At the same time, commentator Tim Bedour says our own way of economic thinking contributed to that tragedy.
I live just 3 miles away from the bridge that collapsed in Minneapolis last week, so perhaps more intensely than some of you, I am asking the question, what the hell has happened to our infrastructure? Some of the reasons our infrastructure have been ignored and that bridge went down are: government is not a solution to our problem. Government is the problem. That's a Ronald Reagan quote. The constant ridiculing of tax and spenders and the it's your money, you earned it, you should keep it drumbeat of talk radio. The union busting, outsourcing, we can do America on the cheap philosophy that has infected corporate America, school boards, state legislatures, all of us. People say this is not the time for finger pointing. Is it a coincidence the very people who say that are the ones who screwed things up? If you ever intend to use a bridge in the future, this is precisely the time to ask, has conservatism screwed up America? Now, conservatism can be very useful. Conservatism is a valuable voice in the process, putting the brakes on social engineering run amok. But having conservatism short-term, bottom-line, give the people only what they think they need now approach as our governing theme has been a giant bust. How's Reagan's service economy looking to you now? How much of your $200-$300 tax cut would you give back to know that bridge you cross every day has been checked out and the money necessary to keep it safe has been spent? Middle class, have you gotten rich off the trickle-down economy? How are those tax cuts to the rich working out for you, middle class? My fellow Americans, things that work, like bridges, cost money. Things that work really well cost lots of money. Things that work really well and don't break because they've been inspected, maintained, improved, replaced costs lots and lots of money, tax money. My daughter was on a school bus that crossed that bridge a few weeks before it went down. Now is indeed the time to point fingers and give a failing grade to the political philosophy that says we can run America on the cheap.
Tim Bedour lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You know where we live if you have some thoughts to share. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Parents of college-age kids are probably digging deep in their wallets right about now, trying to foot those tuition bills. At the University of Iowa, in-state undergrads will pay something near $18,000 this year. School administrators everywhere, not just in Iowa, always say that tuition alone doesn't cover costs, so they have to raise money elsewhere. It's a dilemma that can get fairly pointed at times. Earlier this year, Iowa considered renaming its College of Public Health after Wellmark Blue Cross Blue Shield in exchange for a $15 million donation from the Wellmark Foundation. Stacey Vanek-Smith has today's lesson in education economics.
Corporate cash is no rookie in the field of academia. Any college football fan could tell you that.
It's time for the FedEx Orange Bowl.
Allstate is proud to have brought back the Sugar Bowl.
And Boise State's basketball team fires up fans at the Taco Bell Arena. So, is there really such a difference between naming a stadium after a company and naming a school of health after a corporation? University of Iowa economics professor George Newman says yes. He points out that the faculty voted against the renaming, and he says the head of the College of Public Health was an outspoken critic of the deal.
I know the dean's view was that the perception of independence of research, which is very important for a university, would be partially compromised.
The Wellmark deal has been tabled for now, but other public universities are dipping their toes into these corporate relationships. This fall, geology students at the University of Oklahoma will attend classes at the newly minted ConocoPhillips School of Geology and Geophysics. Professor David Brenneman teaches the economics of education at the University of Virginia. He says if you want to know why this is happening, just follow the money.
The states have been cutting back the share of the support of the universities that they used to maintain. And so universities have been cast into a much more entrepreneurial position where they're having to compete for other sources of funding.
The University of Iowa used to get more than 60% of its operating budget from the state. That's dropped to about 15%. Over the last decade, state contributions to college coffers have been falling at a rate of nearly 1% a year. Rhonda Safady is the spokesperson for the University of Texas school system. She's been watching the University of Iowa controversy closely.
It's a very delicate situation for us.
The Texas Board of Regents recently decided to prohibit universities in that state from naming colleges and academic buildings after companies. But Safady says her schools still rely heavily on corporate money.
If some institutions are not willing to accept it, others are. And, you know, there's an arms race for private money to fund not only our excellence opportunities, but now our core functions are funded with private money.
Last year, corporations gave more than $4.5 billion to institutions of higher learning. John Lippincott heads up the Council for Advancement and Support of Education. He says schools should accept corporate money, but they do need to be vigilant.
Placing a name on an academic program or on a building is a form of branding, and there is certainly no question that one of the most valuable assets that any college or university has is its brand.
But it's not just their own reputation schools should worry about, says economics of education professor Brenneman. He says the academic world holds an honored place in this country, and that is just as valuable as cutting-edge facilities.
We should guard that privileged position we have in American society very jealously. We shouldn't jeopardize it just for 30 shekels.
Iowa's Board of Regents plans to meet next month. On the agenda, possible changes to the guidelines colleges will have to follow when considering slapping a corporate name on a building or school. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, remember the good old days when you bought CDs and then actually owned the songs? You could burn them to your computer and use those digital tracks for whatever you wanted, legal or otherwise. We live now in the world of digital rights management, but the world's biggest music label announced this week it's going to try selling songs without any copyright protection on them. Universal Music Group will be conducting what it calls an MP3 experiment until January. They'll partner with Google, Walmart, and Amazon.com. Conspicuously not in that lineup, Apple's iTunes. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday. Today, the Dow escaped with a drop of 31 points, 0.25%. Up for the week, though. The Nasdaq fell 11 points, more than 0.4%. The S&P 500 closed up just a tick, 0.04%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, long lines, airport inspections. Do you ever wish you could just leave your bags at home?
I enter the destination, the hotel that I'll be staying at, tell them the arrival and departure date, and the clothes meet me at the hotel.
Ah, the dream of luggageless travel. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.